The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, at the United Nations yesterday, there were two important developments. First of all, the report of the Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories. And I'll just read you one paragraph from the summary. By analysing the patterns of violence and Israel's policies in its onslaught on Gaza, this report concludes that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating Israel's commission of genocide is met. One of the key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted jus in bello, the justice in war principles, subverting their protective functions in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people. That was the first development. And then, of course, the Security Council voted to demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, with the US abstaining rather than vetoing the vote. Now, that comes just days after Israel banned the largest aid organization in the Gaza Strip, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, from delivering much-needed food and supplies to the region. Their spokesman joins me now, Jonathan Fowler. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you outline to us exactly the situation as regards getting any aid through to Gaza at the moment?
Well, currently, we have been barred from taking aid to the north. I mean, this reflects a situation which had been persistent on and off since January. We've been unable to get food into the north of the Gaza Strip since January because we've repeatedly been refused permissions. But a couple of days ago, we were informed by the Israeli authorities that they will no longer allow us to conduct any deliveries, any kind of aid operations in the north of the Gaza Strip, which of course is the epicenter of the growing famine there.
Now, what excuse are they giving for making what has been their custom and practice into now a formal declaration?
They haven't given us that information, unfortunately. We made repeated requests every day for the last week or so, and we just received denials without explanation, and the same now. They have said, it's reported that they've said that they will no longer work with us. Now, we are, of course, in intensive discussions about this at all levels, but that's the current situation.
Now, the reason they gave originally for lack of cooperation with UNRWA is because they allege there were people within UNRWA who were complicit in October 7th. Whether or not that should be a surprise, given the makeup of the population of Gaza, that one or two people out of thousands and thousands might be associated with Hamas is not a surprise to me. The Israelis are suggesting it is a surprise to them.
Well, I should stress that we've seen various kinds of allegations over the years. We always take these allegations seriously. We always investigate them. And in this particular case, the allegations against the 12 staff, there's an independent investigation being conducted by the UN Office of Internal Oversight Services. But so to date, we have not received any evidence to substantiate these allegations. Furthermore, we of course, we're talking here about allegations against 12 staff members. Now, across the region, we have 30,000 staff. So 12 out of 30,000 is basically 0.04%. And we are the largest humanitarian organization operating in the Gaza Strip. So if you unplug us, you're basically unplugging the life support system for the population.
How many other organizations benefit from the use of your facilities and therefore their operations also would be frustrated by this action?
Absolutely, yes. You're right to underline that because we are the largest humanitarian organization, the largest UN agency operating in the Gaza Strip, we are the provider of logistical services, all kinds of other services to our partners, including other parts of the UN system. Just to give you an idea, we had, before the war, we had 13,000 staff operating in the Gaza Strip. Now, most of them, the overwhelming majority are people who are members of the community. They're Palestine refugees themselves. They are almost all displaced. Those who are able to continue working, it's varied over time, but 3,000 to 5,000 people. Now, to give you the perspective on that, the combined total of staff from other parts of the UN system it varies, but it's around 200. That's national and international staff combined. So you cannot simply just replace us. And also the other parts of the UN system absolutely do need our logistical chain to in order to be able to maintain their own humanitarian operation.
So what is happening at the moment? How much aid have you got, if you like, on standby? And where is it parked? And how quickly, if the Israelis lifted their embargo on access, how quickly could it be delivered?
Well, yes, that's a very important question. In terms of the amount that's on standby, I mean, we see constant backlogs at the border crossings, so Kerem Shalom and at Rafah, the crossing through Egypt, which, of course, although that is a crossing from Egypt, that still requires Israeli clearances to get our stuff in. But just in terms of what's needed, we could stress that. We estimate that we need around 500 truckloads a day of humanitarian aid. That's including food. Most of that's food, but other supplies as well. But the current daily average is something in the order of 160. So you can do the mathematics immediately. You know, we're not getting anywhere near even half what's required on a daily basis. That does cause a backlog, but then, of course, the other issue is movement within the Gaza Strip, even for the aid that we're able to get in there, because of denial of permissions, you know, safety conditions, and so on within the Gaza Strip, means that there are huge swathes of the territory where people are just simply not getting enough or not getting anything.
Is the other aspect of aid via airdrop or by sea making much of a dent in the starvation and famine problem?
Well, unfortunately not. I mean, just a general rule is that, I mean, the UN uses airdrops extremely sparingly in war zones around the world. For example, we've used them in zones of conflict in Syria or in Iraq, or in geographically isolated areas. In other words, you know, besieged areas where people, we're unable to get the aid in through land. Simply, that's not possible. Here, we're in a very different situation because we should be able to get truck stuff in and truck it around, but we actually can't. Now, is the aid making a dent? Well, of course, all aid in such a desperate situation is good aid. However, there's no guarantee, particularly from airdrops, that the aid will get to the people who have the greatest need, because you know stuff lands, you don't know who's able to pick it up. With the idea of bringing stuff in by sea, that's obviously potentially more efficient than dropping aid by air. But still, I mean, bringing stuff to a port still requires it to then be distributed by truck. So the issue isn't resolved by that. And we have the solution sitting there staring us in the face, which is to bring stuff in through the land borders.
And indeed, the problem with, I suppose, bringing in stuff by sea again, it would be inspected by the Israelis because they are suspicious of anything being brought in that could provide weaponry. And the problem with an airdrop, for example, last week 5 people were reportedly killed when a parachute failed.
Precisely, yes. You've rightly flagged the issue also of airdrops, the issue of safety on the ground. Where does stuff land? Does it land in the right place? And those kind of tragedies, indeed, they illustrate the problem. Airdrops are also more expensive, and what can be carried is much less than on a truck. And yes, the issue of inspections remains, whether stuff is brought in by air, by sea or by land. That's just something that needs to be resolved. I mean, we need a much easier access for aid. We also need clearances on items which have been considered to be dual use, and that's ranged from anything from anesthetics through to solar lamps through to even to scissors in medical kits. Those kind of things have been banned.
The situation in Gaza has over the last few months again and again been described as catastrophic. And sometimes you wonder, where is the peak of catastrophe? I mean, are we at that point now where there are no words to describe what's happening to the people?
Yes, I mean, the point is, you know, we have been sounding the alarm, I mean, including about the food crisis for weeks upon weeks. We are in an entirely man-made famine situation. Over half the population, so around 1 million people, are in a desperate situation, which is tantamount to famine. The other half of the population, deeply food insecure. And, you know, at what point do we reach the peak? Well, unfortunately, the situation just it worsens and worsens day by day. I mean, all we can hope for is that a ceasefire comes into place immediately, because that's the only way to resolve this huge humanitarian crisis.
Now, what do you make from a humanitarian point of view of the motion that was passed in the Security Council with a U.S. abstention? It's not the kind of motion that's going to be paid heed to, I suspect, by Israel, though, is it?
Well, I wouldn't want to speculate on that, but indeed, I mean, it's an important signal about the need to end this war immediately, just because of the nature of the humanitarian crisis. I mean, that's absolutely essential. You know, this war has to end now, because we're in a situation where the largest recorded famine situation, and entirely man-made. This is nothing to do with natural hazard. This is just about shutting off food supplies and the inability to get supplies to the people in need. But indeed, I mean, the Security Council resolution is an important signal. Whether or not it has impacts on the ground, I mean, in terms of those dynamics, remains to be seen. But we have to hope it does, and we have to hope that this happens immediately.
You know, you get the high politics, if you like, which is what plays out in Washington and in Tel Aviv and elsewhere. And then you obviously have Israelis on the ground, soldiers on the ground. Have you seen any sign of compassion on their part?
Well, that's very difficult to say. I mean, I do know that our colleagues do liaise for, you know, on a regular basis, as in any conflict zone. Liaising with the various parties to a conflict, I'm not able to say whether or not there are individual examples that there may be, but I mean the important thing is that everybody needs to come together to solve this crisis, whoever it is and whoever is involved on whichever side.
Finally, Jonathan, I mean, if you can describe exactly what is happening as a result of deprivation of food in terms of illness, in terms of the most vulnerable, the elderly and the children. I mean, are we looking at a death toll which will have nothing to do with armaments or bombs?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the tragedy within the tragedy. I mean, you know, we've had more than 31,000 people killed. That's death from hostilities, effectively. But the big risk is the hunger crisis. I mean, we're seeing, you know, basically things like the measurement of children's arms. So young children, you know, their arms aren't big enough. I mean, these kind of illustrations, when you measure their arms and you see the red line on a measuring tape, you know that they are in a situation of malnutrition. Now, that has knock-on effects, of course. You know, if these kids survive this war, this has a knock-on effect in their later life. We're also seeing the risk of because of the lack of clean water, for example, the risk of waterborne diseases is a constant, also respiratory diseases. All these kind of things are what comes after. So, indeed, I mean, even if there is a ceasefire immediately, the continuing effects of this crisis, they are going to be there, and of course the trauma for a population entirely displaced and facing death and injury on a regular daily basis.
And finally, then, Jonathan, if the embargo was to be lifted by the Israelis, if you could get the trucks rolling again, and, you know, those courageous truckers who do the driving throughout the war zone, how quickly could the first aspect of this, the starvation problem, be alleviated? How quickly could you get the food to the people who need it?
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, if we were able to meet the needs of everybody immediately, then that alleviates some of the impact. How quickly that can be done, of course. I mean, there are risks, you know, moving around among the rubble, these kind of problems, the different kinds of trucks that you need to navigate that kind of war-damaged environment. That's also challenging. Unexploded ordnance, all these kind of things which hamper operations. But I mean, if we can get things moving overnight, then that will dent some of the impacts. But of course, the lingering health impacts, those kind of things, that requires us also be able to scale up medical care. I mean, we have 1,000 medical staff able to operate in our medical centres across the Gaza Strip, but it's extremely, extremely difficult, and we're only operating 8 out of 24, and those are in the south. So, you know, we need to be able to scale up the medical treatment of people who are facing malnutrition and dehydration at the same time as actually just getting food into people's mouths.
Jonathan Fowler, a spokesperson for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you very much indeed.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.